The river presented a boundary as it ran along the southern border of the city, but in reality, the river posed only a state change to Kentucky. People who worked in Cincinnati commuted across state lines. The million-plus population of Cincinnati lived over hundreds of square miles, multiple counties, and dozens upon dozens of towns. Without a centralized population to patrol or contain, the government was helpless with regards to looting, rioting, and unrest, and was toothless implementing any plan to capture the population. As Cincinnati burned, Paul lived safely in the house he and Rachel shared for the last 10 years. He ate, listened to the radio, and read books while he waited for everyone to die. If Cincinnati's timeline was consistent with other major cities on the coasts, Paul would be safe and alone by the end of October. He would begin looking for survivors in November or December. Paul was a pack rat. Rachel kept him honest, making him part with broken items. But Paul's basement held things from his graduate school and bachelor years. He found his old hot plate and an electric tea kettle, both of which would work off his solar panel backup generator. His inability to dispose of bachelor days provided a way to boil water and cook food. He owned an additional handheld solar charger for small electronics, and a solar shower if he needed to get clean. Paul and Rachel enjoyed hiking and utilized solar technology when possible. They were not environmentalists, per se, rather outdoor enthusiasts who wanted fully charged cell phones while on the trail. Paul's life was boring, safe, and offered a few conveniences when the sun shined. He and Rachel, though a household of two, shopped at warehouse clubs. They typically had a few months of food stored around the house. He had a 25-pound bag of rice and a 10-pound bag of dried beans. He had pasta in all shapes and sizes, and he had 30 or more cans of tuna fish. He and Rachel were athletic. Power bars and gels were abundant. Without scavenging at other homes, which he intended to do, Paul had several months of food, perhaps half a year if he rationed. The first month of Paul's solitude was stressful. Paul listened to the radio as newscasters relayed panic and hysteria, the death tolls in the East, the devastation on the other continents, and the 100% contagion and mortality rate of the rapture. Scientists and doctors spoke about not having enough time to figure out the disease. After the first month, the radio broadcasters were gone, replaced by a government loop message, "Survivors should come to government shelters. If you are not sick, seek help immediately. Food and water will be provided." Each day Paul sat on his deck and debated going to a shelter. Some days he would get into his car or jump on his bike, but he never made the trip. Paul was not sure if the shelters were a trick to round up healthy people and use them as guinea pigs, or if the invitation was sincere. The swiftness of the rapture made Paul's decision for him. Everyone died before he could turn himself into the authorities. Paul stayed in his house, bored, whittling away the time reading or staying in shape on his bike trainer. During his third month of solitude, the government messages stopped broadcasting. The lights from Cincinnati were out. Paul waited 2 weeks after the radio went dead before he set out to find other people. It was the beginning of December. An avid cyclist, Paul pulled down one of his bikes to take a ride. The sun was shining. It was a warm late fall day, and Paul needed to see if there were any survivors. He packed a light backpack with 2 power bars and 2 bottles of water. He included a handgun he found in a neighbor's house and pedaled towards the city. His house was east of Cincinnati in a town called Anderson. Decades before, it was a rural area, but urban sprawl turned it into malls, banks, and subdivisions. Before the plague, Paul commuted 10 miles into the city for work, and with all the people in Anderson doing the same, it could take up to 30 minutes to go those 10 miles. As Paul rode towards the city that morning, he made several detours through popular subdivisions. trash was everywhere. Not the kind of trash he expected to find. Not burned-out cars and destruction, but rather regular trash that accumulated over the last months of civilization. When everyone became sick, people stopped working or going outside. Garbage was not picked up. There were mountains of trash, as if there were a garbage strike. Birds and other scavengers ripped and picked at the black plastic bags, spreading waste and debris across the lawns. Grass, unmowed for the last 4 months, grew out of control and went to seed. Once manicured lawns were overrun with weeds. Every neighborhood Paul visited was the same. No people, mild damage, lots of trash. There were a few houses where the front doors were open. Maybe a few windows were broken. But nothing was on fire or showed signs of malice. Paul was sure the open doors and broken windows were from people scavenging for food when the stores went empty. After leaving the last subdivision, Paul stopped at a grocery store. He did not expect to find any usable food, and he did not need any, but curiosity made him hop off his bike to take a look. Outward appearances told Paul his peak was a lost cause. Several of the large glass bay windows, typical for grocery stores, were broken. Even though it was dark inside, he could see most of the racks were knocked over and empty. There were paper products scattered about, but most, if not all, of the food was gone. He took a flashlight out of his pack, walked through the broken front window, and strolled through the store. When the disease began late in the summer and roads were closed, the trucking industry failed. With no one to move or deliver food around the country, stores could only offer their remaining inventories. The food shortage meant groceries were ransacked and vandalized. This market was no different. Paul waved a beam up and down the aisles, but he saw no food, no spoiled meat, not even a box of lentils, nothing. Paul grabbed a few packs of batteries from a revolving display toppled on its side, a box of Strike Anywhere matches, and left. He stopped, turned around, and called, "Hello?" He waited a few seconds. "Is there anyone in there?" Why a person would hide in a ravaged grocery store instead of one of the thousands of abandoned houses, Paul did not know, but he thought he should at least try and find other people. "Hello?" he called out one more time. There was no answer. He slung his pack, jumped on his bike, and continued downtown. He passed the baseball and football stadiums, the financial district, the urban neighborhoods, the university area, and ended his ride through a high-end area close to the city named Hyde Park. He pedaled slowly, calling out for people with his, "Hello!" Paul received no response. He rode down Observatory, his favorite street in Hyde Park. It was a beautiful road ending at Alt Park, a wonderful public space that he and Rachel visited regularly. Paul rode through one of the 25 most populated cities in the U.S. and did not see a soul. He did not see any signs of life, a light, a fire, or smoke from a chimney. He did not hear a sound, a horn, a gunshot, a car, or a bike bell. He was alone. He sat on a stone bench in the park for over an hour. His head was in his hands for much of the time. Why did he not help? He might have prevented all of this, or most of it, if he had just volunteered to have his blood tested for a cure. Paul rode back to his house. He took a shower on his deck using his solar shower, a black rubber bag that warmed 5 gallons of water in the sun and used gravity to dispense the warm water out of a small showerhead onto a cold Paul. He decided to pack his things and ride to Hank's house in Dayton. There was no reason to stay in Cincinnati, and there was no reason to stay locked in his house. The world was over. He had to find a place to survive the winter, and surviving with his brother was going to be easier than surviving alone. He hoped Hank was still alive. The next morning he woke up and hitched a baby stroller attachment, scavenged from a neighbor, to his bike. It was like a 2-wheeled crib with an orange tent over the top, and zipped a child in for rides. Paul loaded it with memorabilia, food, extra clothes, water, etc. He did not know how the roads would be up to Dayton, and decided to travel light and on two wheels. The roads around Cincinnati were clear, but that did not mean he could get a car to Dayton. There could be parked car jams, accidents, roadblocks, and bridge destruction. A bike afforded Paul options, and the ability to travel between and around obstructions. The ride to Hank's house was about 80 miles. Paul was not sure he could make it in one day. The days were getting shorter, and he was towing a stroller, which would weigh him down. He hoped to be up there by early evening, but picked a few points south of Hank's as contingency stops. Paul took weather forecasts for granted his entire life. What is it going to be like today? Is it going to rain tomorrow? Will a storm blow in? Paul was riding blind to Dayton. For all he knew, it could be sunny in the morning before dropping 40 degrees and snowing by the end of the day. It was December in Ohio. When the current warm front would end was a guess for Paul. He hoped the answer was a few days from this morning. Paul went into the backyard to say goodbye to Rachel. He cried, made his peace, and stood at the end of his driveway by 9 a.m. Paul gave his home of 10 years one last look. He and Rachel had been happy here, blissfully happy. They carved a wonderful life with each other. That life was gone. It died with Rachel. He turned and pedaled towards his new life. There was little chance he would ever be as happy again. But whatever lay ahead for him in Hanover was better than living in the shadow of his former life. Paul picked up Highway 75 north towards Dayton. Unlike the day before, he did not call out in search of others. He put his head down and rode. 10. The rapture began in the U.S. on the East Coast, ravaging the large cities up and down the seaboard before leapfrogging the center of the country to devastate the West Coast. Dayton, Ohio did not have a confirmed rapture death until over a month after Raleigh went dark. Hank Dixon survived the rapture. His wife and children did not. He married late in life, and his children were adopted from his wife's previous marriage. None of them carried the cure, or resistance, or what saved Hank and his brothers. Losing his wife was devastating. The death of his four children was soul-crushing. Physically, Hank was alive. Emotionally, he was dead. Hank's neighborhood was relentlessly combed and monitored for rapture-resistant survivors. Many of his neighbors were picked up, visibly sick or not. They were bussed to who knows where for who knows what. Hank's family died early. They were 5 of the first confirmed cases. As soon as he had a plan with his brothers, Hank burned his house to give it the appearance that it was destroyed during looting. He set the southern side of his house on fire, charred the east and west, and scorched the north side. He control-burned the inside, taking out the top floor and marring the walls, floors, and staircase. He kept the basement free from harm, the first floor structurally sound, and the roof weatherproof. Hank moved into his basement, hiding under his apparently destroyed house. He collected water from a hose he ran from his downspout into 2 rain barrels, and scavenged enough food for the 2 months he planned to live underground. He knew everyone would die. He just needed to wait them out. Or not. Hank held a revolver in his hand the first month. He had it to his head or in his mouth most evenings. He alternated between the revolver and a shotgun as he debated joining his family in heaven or his brothers in New Hampshire. He stopped eating. The pounds he accumulated through decades of bad food melted off his body. Hank was not a drinker. He did not seek solace in a bottle or through drugs. He was not a man of faith, and could not pray his pain away. He lived with his anguish. He stared at the grave markers 20 feet from the basement dormer window, and he held a gun to his head while he tried to think of reasons not to kill himself. Hank could think of only one. Hank believed his lost teenage nephew, Greg Dixon, was alive and in peril. Without knowing, and through no action of his own, Greg Dixon saved his uncle's life. Hank emerged from his basement when his crank radio remained silent for weeks. He was pale, filthy, smelled like a dirty sock, and wanted desperately to talk to someone. Despite the time of year and the insanity of his plan, Hank prepared for his rescue trip to New Hampshire. Hank exited the basement with his first stroke of luck since the rapture began.
"Hank?"
A voice called out to the disgusting man.
"Holy crap, are you thin? You must be down 100 pounds.
Paul stood over a bike, having pedaled the 80 miles from Cincinnati. He was soaked with sweat and panted as he spoke. The men walked towards each other and embraced in a strong hug, weeping with joy.
"Okay," Paul said through tears as he stepped away from Hank. "I'm prepared to stay here, but only if we find you a shower. You really, really smell."
"We're not staying here," Hank told his brother. "I have to get to New Hampshire to help Greg." Paul replied with a laugh.
"Are you crazy? It's the middle of December. We won't make it through Pennsylvania. No, we find a house here. We stay safe here and move in the spring. We're no good to anyone dead. For all we know, John and his boys are already in Hanover with Greg."
Hank spoke in a firm and even tone, leaving no room for argument. "You can do what you want. I'm taking a shower, and I'm going to find Greg." 11. Todd spoke to his brother John by phone one last time in September. They connected an hour after the brothers' agreement to meet in Hanover. Todd no longer traveled away from his home to use a dead stranger's cell phone. He called from his living room. Todd assumed and hoped the government and military were too busy to care about a single survivor in Raleigh.
"What's your plan?" Todd asked his brother bluntly. "You have to find Greg, right? Do you want to leave Matt and Craig, or maybe just Craig with me?"
"If I leave one or two of my sons with you, I'm in the same situation I'm in now. Greg is heading to Hanover as soon as he can. I can't risk all of our lives to get up there. If I leave now, we'd get caught and experimented on. If I wait the 2 to 3 months I assume it will take for everyone to die, it will be winter and I risk dying on the trip. I have to wait."
John was resolute in his decision, even though it meant leaving Greg on his own for a harsh New England winter.
"Then what is your plan for coming here from Charleston? Do you want to make the trip to Hanover together? I have young kids. I could use your help and the help of your boys."
Todd could make it on his own. He and Emily were strong. He had 2 good kids, but the trip north would be easier with 3 additional people.
"I'll be there in April, maybe March if it's warm. But let's count on April. Things have started to calm down around here. I'm going to keep the boys in the house and lay low for the next few months."
John's voice was tense, worried, scared.
Todd tried to assure him.
"I don't hear planes unless they're very high in the sky. I'll hold on until April. I won't think about leaving until May. We'll go up together. I'm only 30 minutes out of your way."
Todd added a laugh to the last comment. He heard John chuckle in response, but it was hollow. There was no humor in the situation for John and his boys.
"If the phones go dead before we can talk again, I'll see you in April. Leave a note at your house if you leave earlier."
John cleared his throat.
"Love you, brother."
"Love you too, John."
Todd hung up the phone and turned to Emily.
"We have 6 or 7 months.
Let's wait another 2 weeks and start exploring.
I know we've talked about staying in the attic and living bunker style, but I don't think that will be necessary. Do you?
It will start to get cold at night. We'll need the fireplace in the living room for warmth."
Emily was bored. She kept the kids home since the outbreak started in July. There had not been another sound in Raleigh since the beginning of August. Her children were tired of their yard and watching DVDs. The neighbor's pool was too cold to use, dropping to the low 70s as the nights grew longer. Emily and her kids needed to get out. "I think it will be over everywhere soon. It just happened here first, so it ended here first." Todd patted her knee. They embraced, holding each other for several minutes. "Let's get some sleep, and we'll see what tomorrow brings," he whispered into her ear. They went up to their bedroom hand in hand, checked on their children, and went to sleep. Brazil was the first country to have the disease, experiencing a mini-outbreak with 100 people dying within 1 week of each other. It was thought to be the flu, a deadly strain of the flu, but nothing beyond extra hand-washing and don't-touch-your-eyes-and-nose advice was issued by governments. When similar cases occurred in three Asian countries, Nigeria and Ireland, the alarm bells went off globally. The first person died in Raleigh 2 weeks after the first person died in Sao Paulo. The rapture was worldwide, and more importantly, it was stateside. For the next 2 weeks, while the world panicked and struggled to contain a rapidly spreading pandemic, Raleigh, North Carolina was the only U.S. city with confirmed cases. Scientists retrofitted ideas to explain the symptoms and outcomes, trying to calm the public. The Raleigh outbreak occurred 1 week after the state fair. All of the confirmed cases attended or could be connected to a person who attended the fair. Some concluded the rapture was an animal-transmitted flu, similar to swine or mad cow. Another theory believed it was a mutated canine or feline illness, possibly an airborne version of rabies, explaining why domestic dogs and cats perished during the epidemic. Others believed companies operating out of Raleigh's Research Triangle Park made trips to Brazil, were exposed to the rapture, as it was being called, and brought it back to Raleigh. This theory in particular allowed the U.S. government to believe the disease could be contained. Few people knew the truth. The Research Triangle companies brought the rapture back from Brazil 12 to 18 months prior to the actual outbreak. Containment was not possible. Every person in the U.S. had already been exposed, and the incubation period was over. Panic did not begin with the first confirmed case in Raleigh, but after 1 week and more than 1,500 dead North Carolinians, panic was too mild a word. Throughout the country, daycares, schools, restaurants, and stores closed. Public events were canceled. Downtown streets, typically filled with people, were empty. It was not the 1,500 people dead in Raleigh. It was the 100,000 dead around the world and the millions suffering from symptoms that caused hysteria. The entire population of Raleigh was mandated to leave. Similar to a hurricane evacuation, people were ordered to go somewhere else, anywhere safe. All of the roads heading out of town were jammed with cars for 3 days. If a person's temperature was 1 degree above 98.6, Center for Disease Control officials, as well as U.S. military officials stationed on every road, directed the car to a containment area. Todd stayed in Raleigh because he was afraid of the containment areas. He grew up watching pandemic and outbreak movies in which the government was typically a villain. Todd feared Jay would be taken from them, sequestered, hidden, and lost. If his son was going to die, he would die with his parents and brother, not in some cold quarantine room. No healthy citizens remained within 100 miles of Raleigh. The residents fled without shopping or looting the stores, packing only clothes in expectation they would soon return home. Food and bottled water sat in pantries and kitchens across the area. Supermarket, big box stores, and warehouse clubs were abandoned, still fully stocked. Todd and Emily made smart choices during the weeks of panic. They stayed home, stopped using lights, and powered down their cell phones. They stocked food, used rain barrels to collect water, and prepared for at least 2 months of solitude. Jay's benign summer flu, which made them stay in Raleigh when everyone else fled, was a stroke of luck. When the rapture struck outside of Raleigh, the government did not have the means to handle an epidemic in every state, city, and town. Just a few months into the pandemic, world governments and militaries collapsed. While the globe exploded into hysteria, violence, and looting, the Dixons lived comfortably in their house, safely hidden in the empty city of Raleigh, North Carolina. 12. Greg walked for what felt like hours after he left Ms. Barry's house. He quickly made it to U.S. 495 and then to U.S. 93 North. He was cold and scared in the half-moonlight. Despite what he thought was a quick pace, he was moving slowly and looking around too often. The adrenaline rush of starting his journey wore off, and he was exhausted by midnight. He was on an overpass when he came upon a large sports utility vehicle abandoned on the side of the road. A white towel dangled from the driver's side window. Moonlight showed the car was empty. Greg tried all the doors, and as luck would have it, one was unlocked. Exhausted from just 2 hours of traveling, he decided to take a quick nap inside. He folded the back seats down, crawled inside, unfurled his sleeping bag, and fell asleep instantly. Greg woke to sunlight streaming through the windows of the SUV. It took him a few moments to get his bearings, and he soon realized he was trapped and exposed on the highway, half a mile from the nearest woods. Unless he broke his own protocol and walked in the daylight, he was stuck. He felt a tinge of panic, like a dog when the owner shuts the door and leaves the pet in the car. He looked at his watch. 7:30 a.m. He had two choices. Stay in the car for the next 10 hours using all of his water, or take a risk and walk in the daylight for the next 10 hours. Maybe it was that part of him that was 14 and considered himself immortal, or maybe it was the part of him that had grown up in the last 2 months and realized he was the only person alive within 700 miles. But Greg left the car. Playtime is over. I have to get up to Hanover, and daytime is the best time to travel. He spoke aloud, like he did back in the dorms. I can do this. I can see people coming in the day. I can see animals in the day. I can avoid rocks and things that will twist my ankles in the day. Let's go, Greg. Time to move. Greg pulled out his map, saw an exit about 20 to 25 miles up the highway, and started walking. He stopped and ate a can of cold soup at noon. At 4:30, he stumbled off the highway and onto a rural road along 93 North. He covered just 10 miles of his route. He found a combination general store and gas station, pulled out his sleeping bag, and slept on the floor. The next morning, he filled his water, grabbed what little food was available, and hoped to make it at least 15 miles by sunset. The highways of northern Massachusetts and New Hampshire are cut through mountains and valleys. The roads move up and down, winding around rivers and streams. What a crow flies in 10 miles can take a New England highway 20 miles to connect the same two points. When Greg planned his trip, he did not realize how hard it was to walk long distances in New England. He assumed he could log 35 to 45 miles a day and would be in Hanover by the end of his third day. The late fall season meant exposure to wind and cold, and Greg was not prepared for the up-and-down aspect of the journey. After 2 days of hard walking, he reset his daily goal to 15 miles. But he never reached the goal. He spent each morning mapping how far he needed or wanted to go. If he saw a house that was close to the mark, he would stop for the night. At the end of his third day, he was just 28 miles away from Ms. Barry's house, and still over 70 miles from Hanover. Greg found the trip to be slow and hard-going, and his number one challenge was staying hydrated. He kept 2 water bottles in the slots on his backpack. When he finished the first bottle,
He stopped at the next exit to find a way to refill. Sometimes he could get water right away at a gas station or general store, but exits were further apart as he went north, and stores were not immediately off the exit ramps. Keeping hydrated added time and effort and extra miles to his trek, but if he stopped drinking water, he felt weak and his head ached. Greg might walk 20 miles during the day, but only 8 of those miles were towards his destination. Greg also needed food, and was faced with the decision of carrying weight or relying on scavenging. He opted for scavenging. The rapture was a devastating disease, but it was custom-built for survivors. The earliest symptom was loss of appetite. Supermarkets were looted and emptied, but all the looting did was transfer the food to houses where it sat uneaten. Greg had early success scavenging, but as he entered more rural areas, food was scarce to non-existent. Despite the viscous, cold, unappealing soup he found in cans at the homes where he squatted, Greg was so ravenous he did not care what he ate. One night he considered eating cat food when it was the first and only thing he found in that evening's home. He stayed in the cat house and slept on a couch, but ventured next door and found stale granola cereal. The next morning, he held the small can of cat food, weighing it in his palm. It was light, and would provide a quick meal when he needed it. Greg put the can on the table. "I'm not there yet," he told himself. The weather turned on Greg's third day. Gray clouds rolled in and the temperature dropped to the mid-40s as he walked. Rain fell on him in a steady mist. If the rain downpoured, he would stop, but it teased him by keeping him soaked to the bone while never coming down hard enough to halt his progress. It was colder at night. Greg cut his walking time short each afternoon to find an empty home with a working fireplace. His sleeping bag was soaked and heavy. He abandoned it after the first day of rain. Greg relied on sheets and blankets he found in homes along the highway. 7 days after leaving the broken SUV on the overpass, Greg walked through the toll booths at the end of US 93. He was 60 miles into his journey. He rummaged through the state liquor store at the New Hampshire state line for water and food. Greg was halfway to Hanover. A trip he anticipated taking 3, maybe 4 days, was going to stretch for at least 2 weeks. Greg was down 5 pounds in the last week, and over 20 pounds from when his mother dropped him off at Hightower. He was dirty, cold, slowly losing his sanity, and more importantly, losing his will to continue. The pocket of his backpack held 2 cans of cat food. Unlike the first time he found the lightweight meal, Greg did not leave the cans behind when he discovered them at a house the previous night. He had 1 power bar left before he was out of human food. 1 step away from eating Super Cat Feast. It was close to 5 p.m. He had an hour of light left. Dark clouds remained as rain continued in a steady drizzle. There would be no moon to help him after sunset. Greg left the liquor store with 2 bottles of water and ate a snack-sized bag of nuts he found near a register. He quickened his pace towards the junction of U.S. 89-93. He considered staying at the liquor store, but it had no fireplace, no food other than the measly bag of nuts, and no blankets. Greg was wet and needed a fire to dry his clothes. He approached the intersection of the 2 highways at 5:30 p.m. He noticed a town off to his right and went to find a place to spend the night. He walked down the South Street exit of 93 North, passing the highway motels, and continuing towards town. There were several homes close to the exit, but Greg learned to venture further into towns to find nicer homes away from the highway. He was losing daylight, and his legs were tired, but the reward of a higher-end residence was worth the extra few minutes of walking. A nicer home meant a better chance of food. Low-income families did not keep large pantries. Their homes were bare after the food shortages caused by the rapture. Rural communities, like the ones he found on his trip from Hightower, were also devastated from the food delivery issues.
Tonight he was in an upper-middle-class suburb of Concord, New Hampshire, and had high hopes of locating food other than the feline variety in his pack. Greg strode into the first subdivision and stopped, dead in his tracks. He smelled smoke. He smelled smoke and food. He definitely smelled food. It had been months since he smelled food being cooked. It was a welcome aroma. He lost himself in the moment as he breathed it in, standing in the same spot for several minutes, dreaming of a warm dinner. He snapped out of his daze with the realization there was someone else alive. A survivor. Another person. It was past dusk and the sun was almost gone. Greg determined the direction of the smell and noticed light coming from a window in one of the houses just off of the street. Before he realized what he was doing, Greg ran towards the smell. He was cold, wet, and hungry, and did not want to stay outside much longer. He needed to get out of the elements and into shelter. His heart raced in anticipation of finding a fellow survivor. His mouth drooled as the smell of food grew stronger. "What should I do?" he whispered to himself. He went over his choices. He could avoid the survivor, like his father advised, and keep going to Hanover. Or he could go to the house and meet the person. The risks and rewards of another survivor were equally great. Two people could survive the winter more easily than he could alone. But meeting an evil person could be fatal. Greg wanted to catch a glimpse of the person before deciding. He made his way to an adjacent house, found the front door unlocked, and went to the second floor for the best vantage point. The light coming from the other house was from a fire. Greg was hungry before, but famished after smelling the cooking food. He pulled his last power bar from his backpack and ate his now unappealing dinner. He was still hungry, but out of food. Greg held a can of cat food in his palm. "I'm still not there yet, but I'm a lot closer than ever I thought I'd be." He zipped the can back in his pack. Drawn curtains blocked the windows of the other house, but Greg made out a silhouette of at least one person. Unfortunately, because it was a distorted shadow, he could not tell the gender, age, or size of the person. He went downstairs to the kitchen to scavenge for food. There was furniture in the house, but the cupboards were bare. He pulled a drawer open and felt for utensils. It was empty. "Just my luck," he muttered. Greg was in a house that was for sale before the rapture. It was cat food or no food for now. Greg went back upstairs and sat in the window for an hour watching the shadow move around the room. If it was an older person or a woman, someone he could escape, Greg would knock on the door. If the survivor was a man, Greg would leave and return with his father and brothers next spring. The house with the fire looked new, built to mimic old New England. It was brick on the sides with a large wooden front porch. The roof and shutters were black. The fire was burning in what Greg assumed was the living room. There was little space between homes, standard for modern subdivisions. Greg could easily sit in his cold house and look down upon the warm fire and food house. He was in an upstairs study on the corner of the second floor. A wall faced the firehouse, and another faced the street. Occasionally, Greg walked to the front window to look out. He wondered if any other survivors were coming home. He could only make out one shadow in the firehouse. Greg decided, because it was dark and cold, no logical person would be out on a night with no moon to guide them back home. Greg noticed a dozen trash cans lined up on the street in front of the firehouse, large bins that trash trucks grabbed with their mechanical claw. While Greg was staring at the trash cans, wondering why they were there, light appeared on the front lawn. The warm fire and food house's front door was open. Greg ducked down in the window, peering over the sill. A figure walked from the porch to one of the trash cans with a small plastic bag. The figure opened the can, threw out the bag, and skipped back into the house. Skipped? It was a girl. A young girl. Greg was not a good judge of girl ages, but since she was alive and working with fire, he bet she was at least 12 or 13. Greg knew instantly he was going to approach the survivor. His next decision was how and when to approach her. Did he want to wait a day, come up in the daylight so she was not scared? Did he want to go over tonight so he could be warm next to the fire and eat the food he smelled cooking? He was so excited to find another person, and to find another person close to his age. He decided not to wait. He grabbed his pack, walked down the stairs, walked out the door, and slowly approached the front of the other house. He did not want to scare the girl, and being direct was his best approach. She was probably just as alone and desperate for company as he was. "Should I knock?" he asked himself. "Should I just open the door and say hello?" The front door was wood-framed, with a large glass upper half. There was a storm door with a sign reading, "Model House, Rutledge."
"This isn't even the girl's house. She's squatting," Greg noticed.
He wondered where she lived before moving into this house.
"Here we go," Greg muttered to himself.
He raised his hand and knocked politely but firmly. The girl was on a couch reading a book next to the fire. Her head popped over the back of the couch and looked at the door. Greg wore a big grin, waving slowly. He spoke in a loud voice, making sure she could hear him through the glass doors.
"My name is Greg. Can I come in? I'm 14 and alone. I just want to say hello and warm up by your fire."
The girl jumped up and ran to the door with a huge smile on her face.
"Oh my God, a cute boy's here to rescue me,"
she screamed through the other side of the door. "A cute boy?" Greg thought to himself. "The first person I run into in months is a teeny bopper?" The girl hesitated for a second.
"You're alone, right? You're not with the army or anyone else?"
Greg shook his head.
"At least she's a smart teeny bopper," he thought.
The girl turned the deadbolt and let Greg inside the house. She threw her arms around him and hugged him for a few seconds.
"Oh my God! Oh my God! You're real! And you're another person! And—"
She paused.
"You're all wet."
She stopped hugging him, pulled back, and hit him with a barrage of questions.
"What's your name? Where did you come from? I can't believe you found me. I haven't seen anyone for 7 weeks, since the army truck with, like, 4 people in yellow suits drove through town really fast. Have you seen anyone? Is there anyone else alive? Is the world going on somewhere? Oh, my God, my name is Rebecca. What's your name? I already asked you that, and you already told me your name is Greg. Sorry. Okay, I'll be quiet now."
Rebecca was out of breath from the excitement and asking so many questions. Greg stood in the doorway and felt the warmth of the house in front of him. The cold air was still on his back. He let the questions come.
"Hi, Rebecca. My name is Greg. Greg Dixon. May I come in and sit by the fire? Maybe heat some of my food?"
Greg lied about having food in hopes of eating some of hers, or because he was too tired to remember he did not have any.
"I'll tell you everything I know, I swear. I'm just as excited to meet you. I haven't seen anyone, and I mean anyone, in months." "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," she replied excitedly. "But I can make you some soup. That's pretty much what I have, lots of cans of soup. My parents ran a local grocery store, and they held the last 2 shipments of soup in the basement. I have just about any kind of soup you want."
"Do you have the one with little hamburgers in it?"
Greg loved that soup, but would eat anything she had. She could warm a bowl of water, and he would drink it just to heat his insides.
"I do. Let me get it."
She moved aside to let Greg into the house.
"Come in. Put your stuff anywhere you want and sit by the fire."
Rebecca bounded through the living room ahead of him. She opened a cupboard next to the fireplace and pulled out a can with a red label. She pulled the tab off of the top and poured the soup into a metal pot, more a cauldron, with a wire handle. She hung the pot on a metal rod with a hook and swung it over the fire.
"I looked at a house with a wood stove, but there were people upstairs. You know, not alive. So I decided I could work with a fireplace instead." My dad loved the store that sells all this fireplace cooking stuff. I make it work. Oh, my God, I'm so lonely. I'm sorry I'm talking so much.
Greg warmed his hands, letting heat flow through his freezing body. He sat down and took off his coat and boots. Rebecca continued with questions. She rambled about herself. She even started crying at one point. Greg waited for the soup and listened. He gave yes or no responses when prompted. He knew the girl wanted to talk to someone more than she cared about his answers. Greg was almost in shock. He was hungry, dehydrated, and exhausted. He was not capable of giving more than the one-word responses he offered. When the soup was hot, Rebecca used an oven mitt to grab the pot handle and pour it into a paper bowl. She gave Greg a plastic spoon and sat quietly, waiting for Greg to eat, and more importantly, to answer her questions.
"I walked from Boston."
"Well, Hightower," he began.
"I'm headed further north to Hanover. My family is meeting me there. Probably not until the spring, but maybe this fall. I don't know which, but I know I have to get up there,"
Greg explained as his warm, full belly brought energy back into his body.
"You walked here from Boston? Wow, that's pretty far. Even if we had a car, it would take you over an hour to get to Hanover. And you want to walk? I went to volleyball camp in Hanover last summer."
Rebecca stopped talking.
"Wait. You think your family is up there? Your family is alive?"
Greg nodded. He explained the phone call with his father. He told her that his father, brothers, uncles, and cousins were not getting sick, and they decided to meet in Hanover. He told her one of his uncles was in Raleigh when everything began, and was still alive after a few months.
"My parents died about 2 months ago, just like everyone else in town. Concord and Manchester died early for New England. My parents said it was because half the town worked at the airport and caught it early, but I don't know. I think the whole country died at about the same time."
Rebecca was not as frenetic in her conversation. She was serious and sad when she spoke of her parents.
"How did you end up here? How did you survive on your own for so long?"
Greg was curious because Rebecca was young.
"I'm 13 years old. I'm not a baby. Once I realized I was going to survive, I made some rules, made some decisions, stuck to a plan my parents wrote for me. You know, most of the kids died first. I think because we're younger and still growing, or because we're smaller, but whatever. It was weird that I didn't get sick like everyone else at my school. My parents kept me home, told people I was sick, and held back canned food for me. Right at the beginning, when Raleigh happened, they started hoarding the food, mostly for the town and survivors, and then specifically for me. You know, people could tell they were sick. They weren't hungry, had to force themselves to eat. They just got wiped out. My parents knew, probably a week before they caught fevers."
She paused, wiping away a tear.
"It feels good to talk about it. You know, to talk to someone."
Greg nodded. He knew they would have a lot of time to talk about what he had seen. He wanted to ask more questions about the rapture. He was locked in his dorm when the sick were moved to the infirmary. He did not know much about the disease. Greg knew his mother was dead, and wanted to know how she died, how she was at the end.
"Anyway, I wasn't sick, and my parents kept all this food, and we wrote down some rules. Don't trust the military or the government. Don't trust adults. Don't go outside or be seen or have fires until you know everyone is dead. Don't share your food. I stuck to those until about 4 weeks ago. I haven't seen or heard anything for weeks. At first the airport was crazy busy, and I could see military planes and big jets coming and going all the time. I would sneak up there and watch. Guards were posted, but they weren't paying attention. The military was moving people and equipment and supplies. I have no idea where. After the first week, there were less and less soldiers, less planes. Then there weren't many planes landing. I hid in our house. My parents went to the neighbor's house to die. They wanted to make sure I had a clean place. No dead bodies to deal with. I stayed there until the gas ran out in the fireplace. Oops. Great planning, huh? Gas fireplace? Rebecca laughed. Greg smiled. He loved hearing her story. He enjoyed the sound of another voice. I knew they built this subdivision pretty close to us, and there was a model home with a fireplace, a wood-burning one, not gas like ours. I moved supplies over here, took wood from other houses, and I moved. I kept waiting for someone to show up, even a bad person or the government. I didn't care at this point, you know? I just wanted to see and talk to someone. Greg continued to nod. Yeah, I know. I walked off the highway and smelled the fire and thought the same thing. I had to see another person, even with the risks. I didn't want to be alone anymore. He felt lightheaded, weak from his journey, and he swayed slightly from side to side as if he was about to black out. Rebecca sat on the couch while Greg was on the hearth warming his bones and finishing the soup. She got up and sat next to him, giving him another hug. She began to cry again. Greg was not an emotional person, but this time, unlike the first time she hugged him, he hugged her back tightly. Rebecca felt Greg's ribs under his thick fleece pullover. He was a skeleton. His clothes were filthy and he was soaking wet. She could feel him shivering. She saw the color drained from his face. "You have to get out of these clothes," she announced. "I don't know how you aren't sick as a dog. How long have you been walking in the cold and rain?" Greg had to think about his trip before answering. He was a zombie. "A week, I think. I can't remember." He began to cry. "I don't know. Oh my God, I don't know. A week. I can't get there. I keep walking and I can't get anywhere. I have cat food in my backpack. I almost ate cat food." Greg's composure was gone. Rebecca stood. "Take off your clothes. You need a bath and some clean, dry pajamas. I don't think you have a fever, but you need to rest. I'll drag another couch in from the other room." She picked up the soup pot and poured water into it from a nearby bottle. "Get out of those clothes," she said to him again. "Don't be bashful. Stay by the fire. I'm going to get some dry PJs for you." She hung the water pot over the fire before heading upstairs. Greg pulled off his fleece, folding it neatly on the hearth just behind where he sat. His fingers were clumsy, nearly useless. He was more exhausted and feeble than he realized. Rebecca came back downstairs holding an armful of linen, pajamas, a robe, and a set of slippers. She dropped them in front of Greg. A towel sat on top of the pile. "I'm going into the other room. Call me when you're changed." She looked at the water over the fire. It was forming bubbles, but not at a boil. "Try and hurry. I'm making you more food. You feel like a skeleton. Also, it's cold in the other room. I don't want to be in there long." The young woman went around the corner into the dark. "I'm waiting," she called, as if she knew Greg was still sitting on the hearth and not getting dressed. He shook his head to clear some of the cobwebs that were forming, took off his clothes, and dried himself with the plush towel. He pulled on the clean pajamas, wrapped up in the robe, and slipped the fuzzy shoes onto his feet. "Okay," he called to her. Greg looked like a little old man. Matching light blue plaid adorned his body. The clothes were flannel and warm, but they were slightly too big for him, particularly in his current malnourished form. Rebecca bounced around the corner and clapped her hands. "There, you're starting to look healthier already. I can wash these clothes tomorrow if you want to keep them. I think they should just go in the trash, but it's up to you." She picked up the folded, wet outfit Greg wore just minutes earlier and placed them on the bottom step of a staircase. "I don't know if you'll be able to keep it down, but I'm making you some ramen. I know it's salty, but it's calories. It's fast and it's warm." She opened a cupboard next to the fireplace. Greg saw rows of soup, pasta, and ramen. He saw canned vegetables, fruits, soda, and bottled water.
Rebecca grabbed a package of chicken ramen noodles, placed it into the now boiling water, and stirred the noodles with a metal fork. "One more thing." She jumped up and ran through a swinging door. She returned with an egg and a cold soda she offered to Greg.
An egg? Where did she get an egg? How old is that egg?
Greg's mind asked questions while his mouth remained silent. He opened the bottle of soda and began to drink. Despite his attempts to find water during the trek, he was always on the edge of dehydration. The clear, sugary liquid felt fantastic against his dry throat. Rebecca cracked the egg into the ramen, stirring the noodles rapidly to scramble the concoction. She used her mitt to pull the pot off the rack and poured the mixture into a large plastic bowl.
Eat what you can. I mean, when it's cool enough to eat.
She placed the bowl of steaming food next to Greg. The metal fork she used to stir rested across the top.
I know you're dead tired, but I've been so lonely. Do you mind if I just talk to you? You don't have to respond. I just want to talk to another person.
Rebecca looked at him eagerly.
You have someone to talk to now, he said quietly. We each just made a new best friend.
Greg reached past the food and wrapped his arms around the young girl. They stayed by the fire for a few minutes, hugging. Rebecca let go.
One of my house rules. Trash goes outside in the containers. No trash in the house. Just like that.
With the listing of a house rule, the tender moment was over. Greg did as he was told, walking out to the trash can in his newly acquired outfit to throw away the eggshell and ramen wrapper. It was cold, and sleet drizzled down on him. He was happy to be in a house with a fire, and not trudging towards Hanover, or curled up on the floor of a random house, hungry and cold. He came back onto the porch and noticed firewood stacked on half of the covered porch, conveniently placed next to the door. Rebecca was a smart girl. Greg grabbed an armful of wood to load into the basket by the fire.
There's another sofa in the other room. We can pull it into here. Do you think you can help? I know you're tired. You can call it a night if you need to rest.
Rebecca hoped for his help, but would manage without him if necessary.
Sure. I have one more burst of energy left, especially after the egg ramen, Greg replied.
He ate all of the food. His stomach ached from overeating. 6 months ago, he could eat an entire pizza by himself. Today, his stomach was so small, a bowl of soup made him feel full. He followed her into the other room and helped her move the piece of furniture. When the sofa was in place, Rebecca ran upstairs and came back down with a blanket.
You can take a bath tomorrow. We still have water pressure. I heat water on the fire and fill half from the tub faucet. It's where I wash clothes, too. Anyway, you smell really bad.
She paused.
Let's get some sleep.
Okay, he said with a smile. Rebecca was getting smarter by the minute. Greg grabbed the blanket from the back of his couch and laid down facing the fire. He was the most comfortable he had ever been in his life. Exhausted physically and mentally, his eyes fluttered momentarily as he drifted to sleep. The last words he heard were additional instructions from his new friend.
Good night, Greg Dixon from Hightower,
Rebecca said as she threw a log on the fire.
If you wake up in the night, please put wood on the fire. You can use the bathroom. As I said, we have water pressure. Please flush. We're not savages.
Good night, Rebecca. I'll see you in the morning, Greg mumbled. Rebecca sat on her couch watching him sleep. Tears streamed down her cheeks as she enjoyed her good fortune. She smiled at her sudden companion. Tomorrow she would begin to act like herself, not the young girl she pretended to be. And she would show him everything.
13. Craig's gone again. Matt stood over his father. John opened his eyes, rubbing the corners to clear the sleep.
How long?
I don't know.
He's getting better at sneaking out. Could be hours.
Matt sat down on the side of the bed and tied his shoes. I swear I'm going to strap that kid down tonight, like I don't have enough to deal with.
John's anger was short-lived. In a matter of weeks, Craig lost everything in his world. School, soccer, friends.